You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Skylar Butenchen. It's Thursday, January 22nd. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has launched a new statewide effort to stabilize maternity care as more rural hospitals struggle to keep labor and delivery units open. The governor is directing $25 million of general funds to support hospitals that provide maternity services. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert explains.
$15 million will go to rural hospitals with fewer than 50 beds. Sean Colmer with the Hospital Association of Oregon says stabilization funding can help staff small hospitals.
It's really, really, really tough to recruit, retain staff to be on call 24/7. So what these payments are designed to do is protect and preserve that access for mom when she's ready at any moment's notice to come.
Another $10 million paired with federal matching funds will increase maternity care reimbursement rates for larger hospitals. The funding arrives as Oregon prepares for major Medicaid cuts under the Trump administration's spending and tax bill. State officials estimate the Oregon Health Plan could lose $11 billion over the next several years. I'm Tiffany Eckert reporting.
Rising costs and shrinking income is putting Washington agriculture at risk. Spokane Public Radio's Eliza Billingham reports.
In a Washington Senate committee meeting, ag economist Madison Roy showed a graph charting net farm income. On the right, the orange line suddenly dropped down a steep 45-degree angle.
The last peak in net farm income in Washington was 2021. Since then, we have dropped off precipitously. As of 2024, we were number 43 in the nation in terms of net farm income. You know, if that's not telling in terms of the high costs that we are facing, then I don't know what is.
There are plenty of things cutting into ag viability in Washington. Roy says production prices keep rising while crop prices fall. Labor is the most expensive input for producers. Domestic workers are aging out, and H-2A visas cost a lot. International trade is also critical for Washington agriculture, but Roy says the federal administration is putting more barriers in the way. And Washington's failing infrastructure is putting food systems at high risk. But Roy's colleagues say there are ways to turn things around. Investing in domestic food supply chains, supporting farmers' mental health, improving ag tech, and freeing up land are all ways to keep Washington's ag sector viable. I'm Eliza Billingham reporting.
With a number of housing and office projects in the works in downtown Astoria, and more likely to come in the near future, the city wants to take another look at an oft-lamented and frequently debated issue, parking. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz has more.
One new housing project, the Owens Adair 2, will add tenants to the downtown area, but the new building also removes capacity from an existing parking lot. And there are other housing projects, either in the works or being actively sought for at two other downtown properties. These projects and another for state offices have the potential to add a lot more cars to downtown Astoria. The city and groups like the Astoria Downtown Historic District Association have studied Astoria's parking issues several times in the past. But city leaders hope a new request for proposals could bring in a consultant to get at bigger concerns and help them get ahead of what they expect will be big changes in the downtown parking landscape. Astoria City Councilors say they would want any consultant selected through the proposal process to look at the current and future parking capacity downtown, as well as the types of parking available, and what more might need to be considered. Other items include reviewing the downtown parking map, where parking time is predominantly limited to 2 hours. One question the city will be asking is if this parking map's footprint should change. Councilor Andy Davis wondered about the timing for the request for proposals for this work.
I don't think the landscape has changed that much since the last parking studies that we've done. I think the landscape will change in the next couple of years quite dramatically, but I think the timing for us to put an RFP out right now doesn't feel appropriate to me. If we were talking about whether we want to do an RFP after some of these projects hit the ground and to see what the impact on downtown parking has been, maybe I could see the justification then. I'm not so sure about it now.
But City Manager Scott Spence says the hope is to get ahead of an issue and forecast out needs, possible solutions, and next steps, instead of reacting in the moment. Quinn Hayes, Executive Director of the Astoria Downtown Historic District Association, echoed this during public comment.
It's not so important about the inventory that we currently have and the capacity that we have. How are we managing the resources we currently have? And how can we better manage those resources in the future if we keep adding to that issue, right? And I think that's where the data once we have that data, you guys can help inform a better plan of how we can manage our resources into the future.
City staff plan to create a draft request for proposals for the City Council to consider at a future meeting. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
The Astoria Parks Department will hold an open house meeting this Saturday afternoon, giving community members a chance to give input on what kind of projects they would like to see the department include in their updated master plan. The Parks Master Plan is a detailed outline of the department's goals and priorities for the next 10 years. Astoria Parks Director Jonah Dart McLean says the updated master plan will also serve the department in its grant process. Some of the feedback the city has received so far includes maintaining existing parks rather than building new ones. Dart McLean also noted community members' enthusiasm for a dog park. The open house meeting will be held at 1 p.m. this Saturday, January 24th, in the Flag Room at the Astoria Public Library. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian. Read more online at dailyastorian.com. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden will be in Seaside tomorrow for a town hall. The senator is expected to discuss a number of topics of concern to voters. KMUN's own John Tullis spoke with Wyden ahead of the event and will be airing this conversation around 10 a.m. tomorrow ahead of his usual show, River of Songs. John asked the senator about a number of topics related to our coastal communities, and we are excited to be able to offer that conversation to you. Again, tune in tomorrow around 10 a.m. to catch that. If you want to attend the town hall, it will be held at 12:30 p.m. at the Seaside High School. Be aware that if you do want to attend, backpacks and large bags will not be allowed inside. Clear bags, 1 gallon clear plastic bags, or small clutches plus essential items like medical bags or infant necessities are okay. But there will not be any storage for bags that don't fit these requirements, and guests will not be allowed inside if they don't comply with the safety regulations. Doors open 1 hour before the town hall, which again will be at 12:30 p.m. on Friday at the Seaside High School. Spokane native Colleen Melody is officially Washington's newest Supreme Court justice.
Washingtonians deserve judges who will serve with integrity and humility and a deep respect for Washington's independent role as a sovereign state in our constitutional system.
Melody has been on the job for 3 weeks and already participated in hearings. Governor Bob Ferguson and former colleagues praised her yesterday during her installation ceremony in the Temple of Justice in Olympia. Melody grew up in Spokane and graduated from the University of Washington's Law School. Most recently, she worked in the Civil Rights Division in the State Attorney General's Office. Melody replaces former Justice Mary Yu. The first major tech layoff of 2026 hit Seattle area workers at Meta this week. It's the latest in a series of tech layoffs, with more expected in the coming months. KUOW's Monica Nicholsberg reports.
The steady drumbeat of tech layoffs is driving the Seattle area unemployment rate higher than the national average. It climbed to 5.1% in November, compared to 4.5% nationally.
What plays into that is the concentration of the industries that we have here. So like some of the big industries in our area are like information.
Jeremy Warren is director of impact at the Workforce Development Council of Seattle King County. He crunched the numbers and found that 13,000 people were laid off in the region last year, and more than half worked in tech.
So that's 13,000 people that will be looking for work that are trying to either re-enter or reskill.
And their ranks could grow soon. Next week, Amazon is expected to cut more jobs, according to several people with knowledge of the matter. Monica Nicholsberg, KUOW News.
Conservative group Let's Go Washington is aiming to put more citizen initiatives in front of voters this year. Some Democrats in Olympia are trying to make that process harder. But as Spokane Public Radio's Owen Henderson reports, conservatives may have some unlikely allies.
To get an initiative on the ballot, sponsors have to collect signatures, and they can pay people based on how many signatures they get. Seattle Democrat Javier Valdez's bill would change that, requiring signature gatherers to be paid by the hour.
Our state's current paper signature practice incentivizes paid signature gatherers to use aggressive, misleading tactics. It also enables wealthy interests to buy their way on the ballots.
Valdez also wants to require 1,000 signatures before sponsors even file with the Secretary of State. But current Democratic Secretary Steve Hobbs testified against the bill, as did former Secretary Sam Reid.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, for saying it, but it's a voter suppression bill. It is an attempt to make it even more difficult for citizens to participate in their government process.
The Senate Elections Committee is expected to vote on the measure Friday. I'm Owen Henderson, reporting.
Northeast Washington State Senator Shelley Short wants to change what she views as a state strategy that favors predator animals over deer and elk. Short proposes the state conduct annual population counts of white-tailed deer within areas where gray wolves have federal protection. If the numbers fall by 25% or more, she says it should take steps to move or kill the responsible predators.
We've just seen a lack of management for a very long time and are very concerned about what that means to the longevity of the population.
She's referring to the deer population in her part of the state. Opponents of Short's proposal say the Department of Fish and Wildlife did a 5-year survey within the last decade. Liz Carr from the Kettle Range Conservation Group says it found deer populations are generally stable or slightly declining in some areas. Elk populations are up in some areas.
Scientific studies clearly show wolves and cougars are not causing ungulate declines in Washington. Drought, disease, and human impacts are the real threats.
Supporters of Short's bill say hunters have had fewer opportunities as wolf populations have increased. They argue the state needs to rebalance its wildlife management strategy to give deer, elk, and other predator prey animals a better chance at survival. As the 2026 Washington State legislative session is underway, a bipartisan group of lawmakers have introduced 2 new bills that would raise funds for more sea lion population control. The bills specifically call for the state to begin taking donations for sea lion management during aquatic vessel registration and renewal. If approved, officials who handle licensing would be required to ask clients for a voluntary donation of $1 or more toward a new state sea lion management account. The money raised would go directly to helping protect native salmonid populations. The Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife says sea lions have learned to prey on dwindling salmon species at their most vulnerable points, near dams, salmon ladders, and other natural choke points. In recent years, sea lions and seals have even penetrated Lewis County, making their way miles up the Cowlitz River. The federal government has allowed Washington and Oregon to begin taking lethal measures to remove California's sea lions since 2008. And a newer federal law passed in 2018 made even more allowances for state and federal governments to begin managing sea lions, including removing another species known as the Steller sea lion. But some have complained that efforts to remove sea lions have not been enough, including U.S. Representative Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. The Congresswoman and her team found that Oregon and Washington have not gotten close to removing the amount of sea lions allowed by the federal government's recent laws. Glusenkamp-Perez says that is likely because of the high cost and arduous steps required to remove and euthanize California or Steller sea lions. In determining the actual cost to remove sea lions under federal permits, Glusenkamp-Perez and her team found it costs over $38,000 per removal from the Columbia River. That is roughly $203 per salmon saved in taxpayer money. Both of the bills introduced by Washington state lawmakers looking to raise additional funds for sea lion control were referred to committee. Now they wait to be scheduled for a hearing. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. The old Young's Bay Bridge in Astoria will be closed for an additional day today, January 22nd, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Expect slight delays for after-school drop-offs on certain routes. And a two-day full closure is also expected in February. Once dates are confirmed, the Astoria School District will communicate additional bus impacts. You're listening to KMUN. You're listening to KMUN. Up next, we have the American Democracy Minute, and following that, an episode from the PRX series Travelers in the Night. Stay tuned after that for the Ship Report. Thanks for listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. New lawsuit filings allege a member of Elon Musk's Doge team may have created an external file containing personal Social Security information. That month, that employee and another were allegedly contacted by a political advocacy group attempting to find evidence of voter fraud. The filing comes during discovery for a civil lawsuit by labor organizations, which alleges Doge was mining personal data and violated several federal privacy statutes. The potential breach occurred in March 2025 and disclosed in October. DOJ now alleges a file was created with personally identifiable information for approximately 1,000 Americans. DOJ also said outside cloud servers were used, violating federal data security protocols. The filing reads, SSA determined in its recent review that in March 2025, a political advocacy group contacted two members of SSA's Doge team with a request to analyze state voter rolls that the advocacy group had acquired. The advocacy group's stated aim was to find evidence of voter fraud and to overturn election results in certain states, unquote. While there's no evidence the group received the data, the Social Security Administration IT staff hasn't yet unlocked the file's contents. No criminal charges have been filed. We've linked DOJ's disclosure at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
The Earth's atmosphere does a good job of protecting humanity from space weather. However, occasionally, a major event does break through our shield and gets our attention. On October 30th of 2025, a JetBlue Airways A320 flying from Cancun to New Jersey suddenly dropped in altitude and at least 15 passengers were injured. The incident grounded some 6,000 planes as investigators searched for the cause. Solar activity was initially blamed for a computer glitch, which turns out to have been likely produced by a galactic cosmic ray, which changed a memory location in the program flying the plane. Although this incident was not caused by a solar storm, intense solar activity can cause navigation problems by interfering with GPS, producing radio communications blackouts, causing glitches in the computer programs flying the plane, and producing increased radiation exposure to passengers and crew. To mitigate the potential hazards, it is important for airlines to have redundant communications and navigation systems. Further, it is essential to monitor and analyze space weather to give advance warning of significant events, as is being done by the Chinese Meridian Project. The most extreme solar cosmic ray event of the space age occurred on 23 February of 1956, during which ground-based counters recorded more than a 5,000% increase in cosmic rays. Such extreme fluxes would subject air travelers to dangerous radiation levels, while astronauts in low Earth orbit could face life-threatening situations. Tree rings and ice cores have recorded past space weather events thousands of times larger than that which occurred on 23 February 1956. Investing in research seems wise. For Travelers in the Night, this is Dr. Al Grauer. Stay tuned.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org.
That's news, the numeral one, at KMUN.org. Thanks for listening.